do. It's been 42 days since Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico, home to more than 3.4 million American citizens. 7 out of 10 people on the island still don't have power. The official death toll is at 51, but Puerto Rico's government has confirmed that more than 900 people have been cremated. Earlier last month, firefighters and paramedics from the city of Chicago flew to San Juan. Local organizations throughout Illinois have been mobilizing supplies and finding ways to fly them over to the island as quickly as possible. There's still so much more to be done. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking about that. First, I'm joined now by David Ovalle. He's a reporter at the Miami Herald who just came back from Puerto Rico last week. Hey, David, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, thanks for being with me, David. So you just came back from the island last week. I wonder if you can give folks a sense of broadly where everyone is at. Even though it's been more than a month, if it's been 42 days since the hurricane, what are conditions like?
I would say the best way to describe the conditions in Puerto Rico is just miserable. You know, it's sort of this weird limbo state where things are sort of kind of running, but not really. So people, you know, most people don't have electricity, so it's hard to function doing your jobs. A lot of the businesses still aren't up and running, so then people don't have jobs. So then people are can't make money, and then some of the businesses that are running are only at half capacity because they can't do as much because their generators are limited. So it's just really just awful cycle, and people are miserable. They don't have water. They have to wait in line to get water or to get any kind of relief supplies, and it's hot, you know. So it's a lot of sort of abject overall uncomfortableness for a lot of the people there.
And you wrote about schools opening. Some schools have reopened. As you said, life is sort of returning to normal, but then there's also some schools that who knows when they'll open, right?
Yeah, a lot of the schools are sort of reopening, and a lot of them aren't. A lot of the businesses are kind of like, you know, half there, half not. Sometimes the generators are working, sometimes they're not. At least fuel is relatively easy to get now in most places. A lot of cell service has come back, but really, I think it's just the electricity is the main problem. And of course, you know, Puerto Rico was already suffering a lot from economic woes and you know, lack of jobs and lack of services before the hurricane. So now you're getting a lot of those same issues creeping back up again. The crime, which was averaging about 2 murders a day in Puerto Rico, is now kind of back to that normal level. And now it's an all cash economy, so people are for the most part, so it's a little more opportunity for people. So there's just a lot of, it's just a weird limbo state where it's like half functioning and then just miserable for a lot of people there.
Right. So I know the Miami Herald has been sending people down every week. You're also cover your normal job is covering crime for in Miami. You wrote about crime in Puerto Rico. How much is that a concern right now, too? I mean, when you're describing people not having electricity, people being miserable, people not being able to work in an all cash economy, doesn't sound like that adds up to a great equation when it comes to crime, right?
No, and unfortunately, the crime wasn't great before, you know, it was an issue beforehand. And now for the average Puerto Rican, it's a concern. I mean, obviously, you have a lot of sort of federal security that's there guarding a lot of the shipments and the gas and some of the water supplies and stuff like that. But for the average people, you know, I'll give you a good example. We were out with the police, and there was a robbery in a neighborhood where it's normally gated, but the electricity was out, and so the gate is open, so people can just go in and somebody rob someone. There was a robbery at a Subway restaurant where, you know, it's all dealing in cash right now. So some guys went in, and a prosecutor happened to get shot. He was just sitting there having dinner with his girlfriend. So a lot of stuff like that. I mean, even little things like, you know, there's a lot of downed wires. So a lot of the homeless men are taking the wires and burning them so they can get the copper inside. So now you have a fire threat. So it's just a lot of little things like that. I mean, you know, stuff. I mean, it wasn't great beforehand, and now it's just sort of made a little bit worse.
That's David Ovalle from the Miami Herald giving us a sense of what things have been like. He just came back last week from Puerto Rico. David, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
In studio with me here in Chicago is Cristina Pasiones Zayas. She's co-chair of the Puerto Rican Agenda. They're an umbrella group of about 30 different Puerto Rican organizations in the Chicago area. Cristina, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you for having me.
You've been sitting listening to David, and I saw you nodding your head and kind of shaking your head at certain points. I mean, I imagine what David's saying from a journalist's perspective is a lot what you're hearing from friends and family on the island.
Absolutely. You know, the issue of electricity is huge, as well as water. Even though the reports from FEMA are saying that 75% of homes have water, you know, they have to boil the water. It's not potable. And there's a lot of disease in the water. And we have to kind of question some of the information that's coming out about the stats in Puerto Rico, even though it sounds like electricity is increasing in terms of the number of homes that have access to it. The power grid was already weak as is, and so that's just a huge issue of it going in and out.
And even if you have 70% of people who don't have power, that's a huge number. Mm-hmm. So even if that's going down to say 60%, that's still
right. And you also have to think about what electricity powers, right? So it doesn't only power our ATMs, it powers people who are dependent on medical devices and the fact that they can't get, you know, certain treatments. We have a lot of hospitals, you know, operating off of generators. It just, you know, it's unimaginable that these conditions are happening in a territory that is full of U.S. citizens.
And I think that I wonder when we think about that, you know, we were talking about this morning, actually, producers, about looking at different surveys that have been done since the hurricane of people, of how many Americans are not aware of the fact that Puerto Rico is part of this country. Do you feel like some of the response or the lack of response has been because people are either not aware or don't really recognize Puerto Ricans as part of this country?
Partially. I mean, I would say it's just really a revelation of what a lot of us had already known, and that Puerto Ricans are second-class citizens. It's a relationship of convenience for the United States. And really what it's done is reveal that essentially it's a colony. And this colonial status has influenced every single aspect of life on the island. And so those that had doubts about this type of relationship, now there's no question. It's very clear that, you know, the effort at the federal level is lacking. It's embarrassing. It's inhumane. And that should clearly communicate to people how Puerto Ricans are perceived from the perspective of the federal government.
There are lots of course, there's a huge Puerto Rican community here in Chicago, across Illinois, people who have been mobilizing to help with your organization, this umbrella group. Can you tell me a little bit about, I know initially, just about a week after the hurricane, you all were able to get planes donated to help to fly supplies down. Are you still able to do that from a consistent basis? Are you getting supplies in from O'Hare into San Juan or wherever other parts of the island you're going to?
So we have one more flight that we're planning for, and it'll be our final flight because it has just been a logistical nightmare. Initially, we were not collecting supplies because we felt it was a lot cleaner and more efficient if we just collected money, and then we translated that into pallets that we purchased from wholesalers and then got them on planes. So this third flight, there's been groups from all over the Midwest that have been contacting us with pallets. And so we have them in a warehouse right now.
And is that water, supplies, everything?
Everything from medical supplies to emergency supplies to sustainable energy. And so right now we're in the process of repackaging them, ensuring that they're up to the federal shipping regulations. And then we will get them to the airport and out. Boeing is working with us with one of their subsidiaries to get that third flight out. Well, I should say third and final, because we're done with the flights, because we've actually shifted strategy. Our campaign used to be called Pallets and Planes, and now it's Pallets in Puerto Rico. And so now we're simulating the local economy with the donations that we've been receiving by purchasing directly from Puerto Rican-owned businesses and distributing them on the island. And so we've worked really closely with Congressman Gutierrez, who's made a couple trips on our behalf.
I think he's going back again tomorrow, right?
He is. Yeah. He's actually going to be taking cash donations from us. We are Going to be giving $5,000 to the town of Jayuya, $5,000 to Bayamon, and $2,500 to Loisa. And there's different groups that we've collaborated with that are going to get that cash out to families. And so Congressman Gutierrez has really been a great partner in this process.
We also saw Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel saying that for people, you know, this has been, I know this has been somewhat controversial, how many people have left the island. There's been a lot of stories about, in fact, the people who can leave were already leaving. And now a lot of the younger generation really is leaving and leaving, unfortunately, a lot of older folks behind. I want to ask you about that in a second. But first, I want to say Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel was very open about the fact that if people needed to come to Chicago, even temporarily, this would be a place for them to come. Has that happened? Have we seen a lot of people come here?
Yeah. So when he made that announcement at the beginning of October, there had been about 1,600 individuals registered coming from Puerto Rico. It wasn't clear if Chicago was their final destination. But we've been working really closely with the mayor's office to get information out to families that have been contacting us because they have relatives or they have friends that have come, and connecting them to the appropriate resources so that they can get integrated into Chicago. As a matter of fact, tomorrow, what they're calling the MARC, the Multi-Agency Resource Center, is going to be opening up in the Humble Park Fieldhouse from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And it'll be open tomorrow and Friday, and then the following weeks it'll be every, I want to say, like Monday and Tuesday.
To help people with resources?
Absolutely. It's going to be a one-stop shop. So you're going to have DFSS there, FEMA, because, you know, now the TSA, Temporary Support Assistance.
Okay.
They will be there to kind of advise people if they are eligible to get hoteling for 60 days. There will be Chicago Public Schools there, the Chicago Housing Authority, all the social service agencies. Really, it's an opportunity that if people are looking to stay here temporarily or stay here in the long term, there's going to be this resource center there to kind of help case manage you through the process.
What do you see as the biggest need on the island right now? We were just talking before we went on air about your family, your grandmother. Mm-hmm. And I just want to go back to the fact that we know that a lot of people who haven't left the island are people who are older, who are not able to do so, or simply don't want to, or don't have the means to.
I would say, first and foremost, water. Clean, drinkable water is absolutely necessary. And then after that, you know, comes food, right? Food that you can actually prepare. You're not just eating Vienna Wieners and Chef Boyardee. And then after that is the cash so that you can get, you know, the items that you need. Congressman Gutierrez, in his last trip for us, when we went, did a distribution in five towns in the interior of Puerto Rico, he noticed that people were sleeping on floors. People were sleeping on concrete slabs in tents with their children. And he ended up actually using some of the funds that we sent with him to purchase mattresses for people. It's something so basic, but, you know, obviously people's, you know, beds and all of their items got damaged in the storms. They don't have a roof, you know. And so one of the things that we're starting to move towards is using our dollars to purchase mattresses and also to help people reconstruct their roofs, because we can't forget it's a tropical island. You're still getting tons of rainwater.
And still really hot, as we're hearing, too, right? So you need protection during the day, shade.
Shade.
Well.
And another, I think, you know, request that we're getting from folks are like D and C batteries.
Right. And to power fans and flashlights. Yeah, which all of these things that we think about on a daily basis, especially after a hurricane. I know, having lived through many current hurricanes myself, how miserable it is afterwards when there's no water, when just it's just hot and you don't have a fan. And then when you're walking up and down stairs because there's no elevator.
Right. And not to mention, you know, people who are dependent on medicine or medical services. Right. So there's a huge need. We've partnered with Lurie Children's Hospital. They've donated $20,000 worth of medicine that we're bringing to the clinic in San Juan, the children's clinic. And so, you know, it's just those really basic things that you kind of forget about. But in times like this, are so critical for people's well-being.
Christina, for people who are listening and want to help, what would you suggest they do?
Of course, they can visit our website at PuertoRicanChicago.org, and they can learn about our campaign, Palace in Puerto Rico. We actually, this Saturday, Chef Amaury Rosado, who is from Humboldt Park here in Chicago, he is doing a pop-up restaurant, and all proceeds are going to our Palace in Puerto Rico campaign. And it's only for 50 individuals. The tickets are $160, and like I said, 100% is going right to our campaign. So I would say that the best way that people can donate, I'm not going to tell you exactly what you need to do in terms of which organizations. I would say investigate the organizations you're giving money to. Make sure that they have a transparent process so that you can understand where your dollars are going. In our case, 100% are going to Puerto Rico. We have no overhead. If you are to donate supplies, which I'm hearing that people are having a hard time getting those supplies out, investigate about what their plan is for distribution. And then lastly, if you can get cash to the island, that would, you know, directly to community-based organizations, that would be another route.
To help Puerto Rico recover from Hurricane Maria, as we said, 42 days since the hurricane, lots of people still in need there. I want to thank Cristina Pasione-Zayas. She's co-chair of the Puerto Rican Agenda for joining me. Thanks, Cristina.
Thank you.
Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you've ever moved to another state, like millions of Americans have, you probably didn't call your county clerk to tell them you're going to vote somewhere else during the next election. So election offices across the country share voter data using programs they say help track whether you're registered to vote in more than one place. One of those programs is called CrossCheck. It's a program developed by the Kansas Secretary of State's office. It's used in 28 states. But last month, the progressive advocacy group Indivisible Chicago filed a public records request that showed there could be some major security concerns. When Indivisible got copies of emails between election officials through this public records request, they saw these emails had usernames and passwords that are used to access millions of people's personal information. All of this as President Trump's Voter Fraud Commission is trying to get states to send along voter information they have, promising that security breaches like this one won't happen. I'm joined now by Jeff Radue. He's the leader of the Indivisible Chicago Task Force on CrossCheck. Also on the line from Washington is David Becker. He's executive director of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. Jeff, David, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
David, let's start with you. There's a lot here about voter data and election security. Some of this can get a little technical. I thought we should first just start by explaining. Can you explain to us what is CrossCheck?
So CrossCheck is a program that was started back in 2005 by a previous Kansas Secretary of State with some other regional secretaries of state of both parties to try to address a problem that is a real problem in America, which is that Americans are mobile as a people. They move in between elections. About a third of all Americans move between in any given four-year period of time. And in order to keep voter registrations up to date, it's important to try to have access to some information about whether someone moved, but it's very, very hard to do. I think one of the challenges CrossCheck had when it was formed is it had limited technology that was at its disposal. It uses very, very limited data fields, and it really only looks backwards using name, first name, last name, and date of birth primarily to identify whether or not a record in one state might have matched a record in another state in a previous election. As any statistician will tell you, or anyone who studied voter lists like I have will tell you, first name, last name, and birth date is a very, very bad way to match. It does not create any kind of conclusive record. And so, for instance, there are well over 5,000 John Kellys in the United States, and likely over half of them share a birth date with another John Kelly who spells the name exactly the same way and, again, has the same exact birth date. So being able to do that is very important, but CrossCheck has some challenges in doing that accurately, given given the data it takes in and the way it secures its data.
Jeff, is that what initially had you and other folks at Indivisible Chicago so concerned about this program?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of many issues that our team has a problem with regards to CrossCheck. CrossCheck, our state of Illinois participated in CrossCheck in 2010 and continues to participate as a member. When we started doing our research into the program back in the summer and realized that Secretary Kobach was the manager of the program, had been, you know, the one that's kind of pushing this notion that hundreds of millions of people are voting illegally in elections, we began the process of figuring out, you know, what Illinois' involvement was, and realized quite quickly that not only had they been involved for a while, but there are some serious security concerns with regards to just basic operating procedure that CrossCheck instructs election officials to participate in. And you've mentioned a couple of those things: emailing usernames and passwords to FTP servers that house this data, emailing decryption passwords from state election authorities to cross-check authorities in Kansas, and vice versa, emailing decryption passwords to results files to literally all of the participating members of CrossCheck. And all of those present a very serious cybersecurity concern. And I think when we look back at the 2016 election and all of the hacking and outside actors looking to influence voter registration information through cybersecurity breaches, this is something that all Americans really need to be concerned about.
And when you say that, Jeff, with security concerns, essentially, was there any type of, and David, feel free to jump in here also after Jeff, was there any kind of protocol for how this information should be shared securely?
Well, if you look at another program that Illinois has legislated itself into, it's a program called ERIC, the Electronic Registration Information Center. They utilize encryption formats to be able to transfer hashed or anonymized data between state election authorities and the ERIC program. This is something that CrossCheck does not do. Sensitive data like last four of your social security number, your name, your birth date, your address are all transferred out of the state to a centralized server that's housed in Arkansas. And then CrossCheck officials in Kansas upload it from the Arkansas FTP server. A system like ERIC uses an SFT server, and that may sound, you know, technical jargon to all of those listeners out there, but it's an encrypted form of the server. And so what we want to make sure that we've got in place are election officials utilizing appropriate technology and appropriate programming protocols to receive and transmit this data, rather than using emails, as we all know, are very susceptible to hacking.
Yeah, Jeff is exactly right. I helped found the Electronic Registration Information Center, or ERIC, and I can tell you, we in the states that participate in it, which are include Illinois and 19 other states, and is growing probably beyond that in the next few years, took years to develop security protocols before a single piece of data was shared. And it's much newer. It's much more sophisticated. It's designed to give much more credible data matching between states, so there are fewer what are called false positives, where you inadvertently match two records that shouldn't be matched. But also, very importantly, to Jeff's point, there are security considerations that are put into place. So the data is anonymized before it ever leaves the state's control. There are very, very limited IP addresses that can even access the SFTP sites. And if you're not at one of those just a few dozen IP addresses, even if you have the login credentials, you won't be admitted, you won't be permitted access. So it's very important that whenever you're sharing personally identifiable information in any way, that you take the time necessary and talk to the experts necessary to develop the kind of security protocols to make sure you've adequately protected that data. And I think, as Jeff pointed out, I think ERIC does that quite well.
I guess I have a question, Jeff. Part of your concern seems to be that people have access to personal information, but then part of the concern is also that it's just name and birth date. So are there other, is there other personal information that's also accessible beyond someone's name and birth date that you're concerned about people having access to, should they, since it's not a secure system that this information is being passed in?
Well, if you think about how people open up credit lines of credit or identify themselves at banks or other financial institutions, oftentimes it's things just as simple as first name, last name, middle name, last four, social security number, address, zip code, things like that. So the data that's being transferred to the CrossCheck program is enough data that could be utilized to falsify an identity. Not only that, but if a hacker were to be able to access a results file from CrossCheck, they would be able to access enough information that could potentially influence a voter registration file without an election official perhaps knowing it at the time. There are a series of vulnerabilities within the CrossCheck system that concern us. Not only that, but I think the other aspects.
So I'm sorry, just to,
that I think are important.
Yeah, sure. just to stick with that for a second, though, there is information other than just first name, last name, and date of birth that's available in the system that people can get to, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, when data is uploaded to the system, it is more than just first name, last name. That's all they analyze in their algorithm is first name, last name, and date of birth. It's called a two-point match. But state election officials upload all of that other information that I just described.
I see. Okay. And so that makes sense, the concerns that you have then also that makes sense in terms of concern for data. I interrupted you. You were going to finish your thought about some other concerns that you had, Jeff.
So, what I was going to say is additional concerns are how that information is being used, how gross results or results from CrossCheck are being used for what we would describe as propaganda purposes by the managers of those programs. Chris Kobach has been known to mislead the general public with regards to the instance of voter fraud in the country. There are examples in New Hampshire, examples in Indiana and Ohio where CrossCheck data is being misused. So in Indiana, the state of Indiana is currently being sued by the NAACP and the Brennan Center. I believe there's also a second suit that was recently filed against the Secretary of State with regards to a law that they've got in the state that is contrary to provisions within the National Voter Registration Act of 1993 and utilizes CrossCheck as a purging tool, which would then purge voters off of the list without requiring that the election authority communicate that purge to those registered voters. And when we're considering that results that come back from CrossCheck are over 99% false positive, has been statistically shown to be over 99% false positive, we're concerned that legal voters in other states other than Illinois are being purged off of the rolls inappropriately.
That's Jeff Radue. He's the chair of the Indivisible Chicago Task Force on CrossCheck. We're talking about this electronic system developed by the Kansas Secretary of State's office. It's used to try to verify voter information. On the line with us from Washington is David Becker. He's executive director of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. We should say we did reach out to the Illinois State Board of Elections, and the assistant executive director, Bernadette Matthews, told us they've received many communications from lawmakers and citizens and that they're aware of concerns about CrossCheck and that they're evaluating all the information related to the program. Jeff, before I get to you, David, can I just ask, as we look at, are there other states where people are doing what Jeff and Indivisible Chicago is doing here in Illinois regarding CrossCheck? Is this happening across the country, people challenging this?
Well, I think Indivisible Chicago was the first to unearth the significant security concerns raised by the transfer of data with regard to CrossCheck. But there are many who have raised concerns about how CrossCheck is used to conduct what's called voter list maintenance to keep the voter rolls up to date. CrossCheck, just like anything else, including ERIC, is a tool. But of course, and again, Jeff mentioned this, it has to comply how you use that tool with federal and state law, and in particular the National Voter Registration Act. which says that just because you receive information that someone might have moved doesn't mean that you can just automatically remove them from the list. You have to try to contact them and confirm that information before you can even do what's called inactivating them, which doesn't remove them from the list. It still would enable them to come and vote. So if states are not complying with that federal law, whether they use CrossCheck or any other tool or whether they use neither, that, of course, should raise concerns because that's a law that applies to virtually every state.
And, David, has that happened yet? Have people been taken off voter rolls and they don't realize it until election time?
Well, yeah, sure, it happens in some places. It happens in some states far less than in other states. Every state is trying to do a pretty good job of allowing for all the eligible voters to get onto the list that want to be on the list, while also trying to make sure that their lists are as clean as possible with as much up-to-date information. And for a long time, they didn't have really good tools to do that. ERIC, which has been around since 2012, I think has proven to be the best tool to get information in a timely way about whether someone has moved, to enable the state to proactively reach out to them and contact them before the next election and try to get them to confirm that information so that those people will be able to vote without a problem. States that are using ERIC are finding that they're having a much easier time keeping their rolls as up-to-date as possible without accidentally taking someone off that shouldn't be taken off. And that's one of the reasons I think in just 4 to 5 years, ERIC has grown to 20-plus states.
Jeff, we have just have about a minute or two left, but I just wonder what you would like the state of Illinois to do. Indivisible Chicago has filed this public records request. You've unearthed this this potential security problem. What would you like the state to do?
Well, we want the State Board of Elections to discontinue its voluntary participation in the CrossCheck program, and that's an important notion. The ERIC program is legislated into the state, so it's law that the state participate in. And CrossCheck was a voluntary program that can easily just be reversed by a vote within the State Board of Elections body. And so we're asking the body to take up the issue on its official agenda, which it has refused to do, and we are asking for them to vote to discontinue the program. If they refuse to do that, then we're going to work legislative angles on November the 7th. Senator Cunningham with the Information or Telecommunications and Info Technology Committee is calling the State Board of Elections to testify with regards to their participation in the CrossCheck program in light of the security concerns that we've highlighted. And we expect more legislators to jump on with regards to pressure. Senator Durbin and Senator Duckworth on Thursday released a letter to state election authorities urging them to end their participation in CrossCheck as well. And so that's what we're looking for. Yep.
So that was last week, that letter. There's a committee hearing about this in the State House next week. We'll be keeping an eye on that for all of you listening. I want to thank Jeff Radue with Indivisible Chicago and David Becker as well for joining us from Washington, where he's executive director of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla.
Coming up, we're going to be talking about fall leaves and drives. If you have suggestions for your favorite fall drives to see leaves in Illinois, give us a call, 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21STShow, and we're going to have that conversation just after the break.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. While temperatures are dropping and daylight is shrinking, we've got to embrace the good things about fall, which include one of the best colorful leaves. We wanted to help you get out there and enjoy all of the beautiful foliage that Illinois has to offer. Whether you're coming from Chicago or Champaign or Rockford or anywhere in between, you can hit the road and take in oranges, reds, and yellows, and maybe make a fun pit stop while we're at it. Our guide on this fall leaves trek is Nuno Ribeiro. He's an assistant professor at the University of Illinois Department of Recreation, Sport, and Tourism, and in our Urbana studios. Nuno, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. It's an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, this is so exciting to talk about fall leaves. We love this. It's like the most beautiful time of year for all of this.
It certainly is.
For all of our listeners, you're welcome to join us with your favorite spots. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet as well to 21STShow your pictures or your ideas. So I have to ask you, Nuno, it's not too late, is it?
It is absolutely not too late. In fact, we are at prime time to enjoy probably, I think we're going to get very lucky with the weather. I think we have at least a very good week and a half, maybe possibly 2 weeks, to experience fall in its absolute prime.
Oh, well, that's perfect. And I know you have picked out some great drives from
us. I do.
So you've had tons, right? You picked out two drives from
Chicago.
It was
very difficult. It was, Nyla, it was incredibly difficult because it's such a beautiful state with so many locales, both known and not so well known, in which to enjoy the beautiful fall scenery that we are lucky to enjoy in the state, that I had a very difficult time. So I want to apologize in advance. I mean, if I don't mention your favorite spot, please call our show and tell us about it. with that in mind, you know, Illinois is the type of state that has a lot of this, we like to call the hidden gems, right, Nyla? And I know that in the show you've talked about a lot of them. So it's, I tried to pick a couple spots that while they may be known to a lot of people, they may be not known to everyone. So perhaps we could start our trip, say, from Chicago.
Well, actually, I was thinking we should start from where you are.
Okay.
Near Urbana. So let's start the opposite
direction.
Okay,
so if we head south,
right,
if we drive about 170 miles, we can visit Alton, which is right near St. Louis, and it has one of the most beautiful pieces of drivable scenery within the United States with absolutely zero exaggeration. The Great Rivers Road is one of the most beautiful and scenic drives you can take in North America. Dare I say, in the entire American continent. It is a scant 170 miles away. It is a beautiful, it's about 50 miles along the river, Nyla. It is gorgeous.
Give us directions here. Where would you go?
We would head straight south towards St. Louis and then detour to Alton. And I would make a delicious detour while in Alton and go to a place called Mygis Desserts. And I just can't help myself and just have one piece of pie.
Okay.
I usually go for two or three.
So would that be, so then would you be taking 55 there?
Uh-huh.
Would you be
taking,
so that would be 55. Okay.
Yep.
55 south from Champaign.
And it's about, you know, if you take a pit stop, you know, just 3 hours or so. It's a nice day trip, although a little tiring, so I might recommend staying overnight. Plenty of beautiful places to stay, you know, go out for a nice dinner. Because on the way back, I would say, you know, stop at Pere Marquette State Park.
Yes, tell us about Pere Marquette
State Park. So Pere Marquette State Park has perhaps, they have about 12 miles of beautiful trails. And it has these beautiful, tiny little hidden waterfalls, these beautiful boulders. If you are photography fans, it's one of the most beautiful places to take those amazing fall photos, either by yourself, with your friends, with your family, significant other, those beautiful kid photos. It's just absolutely gorgeous.
So you can do all of your holiday photos now.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. And again, go eat pie. Eat
right.
More pie. I think most people need to eat more pie.
Well, especially this time of year. This is the perfect time of year,
yes.
Right?
Yes. It most certainly is.
So that's if you're going to go south. That's
what if
Alton.
You go west?
Right.
From Champaign, it's a little bit closer. It's about 140 miles towards Galesburg.
Okay. And that's going to go through. So then are you going to go, so you're going to go Galesburg, but are you going to go
through Bloomington and Peoria?
Okay.
Yes. And there is plenty to eat and drink and see in both Bloomington and Peoria. So apologizes in advance if I don't mention all of your favorite spots. I just want to highlight
all of our listeners who are in Bloomington.
Yes, they're all marvelous.
Yeah.
Trust me. Please, we want to hear about them. In Bloomington, I want to highlight the old courthouse in Bloomington, which is now where the State History Museum is. And it is an absolutely beautiful building. It's at a great museum, loads of great places to eat, depending on what you like, right around the courthouse. It's an absolutely beautiful place. And also, on your way near Bloomington, a scant about 17 miles on I-55, in the little village of McLean, Illinois, population 830, more or less, there is a place, Nyla, where the 1980s and the 1990s have survived. Arcadia, America's playable arcade museum and pinball paradise. Now, if you remember Dance Dance Revolution and Mortal Kombat and all those arcade games that ate a substantial portion.
I must say I'm not a huge aficionado of arcade games, but I think you are. It sounds
I am.
Like.
They yeah. consumed a substantial portion of my allowance when I was a kid. And there's the element of nostalgia, not just arcade games, but pinball. I'm a huge fan. And there's an arcade playable museum and pinball paradise that you have to see it to believe it.
In case you're tired of looking at leaves for a bit,
absolutely.
You can take a little break from that. Okay.
Not to mention there's a vintage Wurlitzer with all the 80s and 90s catalog, all the Depeche Modes that you can possibly think, they're all there.
Okay.
So as we move on, we might do a little pit stop in Bloomington, and I might eat beautiful Thai food in the little kind of sort of tucked away in. It's called the Thai House of Bloomington. And I think it's probably one of the best Thai meals that I've eaten in the state, Chicago included. So it's tucked away on the way towards Bloomington. It's just about a 5-minute drive off the interstate. I might top off that meal with a delicious coffee by an award-winning coffee shop and roaster called Coffee Hound Roasters. If you're really nice, and I'm sure all our listeners are, if you ask for a tour of their roasting facilities, please do so. They are more than willing to oblige. The coffee is delicious, and it's very, very educational.
Well, Nuno, you're talking all about, there's a lot of food, so I feel like people are going to need to work off all of this
absolutely.
Food by going probably through some parks. So you had mentioned Père Marquette State
yes,
Park as a place.
That is a great segue
great for leaves.
Because
yeah.
you can burn off all those calories along one of the most beautiful trails that we have in the state, which is right off of Bloomington. It's the Constitutional Trail.
Where does that run along?
It runs right through Bloomington, and it heads west, northwest. It's just absolutely magnificent, and you can walk, hike, take photos, jog, run, bike. It's an absolutely beautiful trail.
Okay, so we've done south and central Illinois. Let's go a little further north. What about
right.
Kankakee?
All right.
In the Kankakee area.
If by any chance, if we are heading south from Chicago, about 60 miles south from Chicago, we head towards, and Nyla, this is one of my favorite hidden gems of Illinois and my favorite parks. It's Kankakee River State Park. And I think for my money, it's probably one of the most beautiful hikes I have taken in the state. It's just magnificent. It's all along the river. There's about 11.5 miles of beautiful manicured landscape trails. You know, the state workers at DNR and the state parks, they do an absolutely marvelous job. And it's just so scenic and so remarkable. It's very difficult to disconnect from your phone because you'll want to post this on Instagram like I always do.
No. So Kankakee River State Park, is that off of 57 then?
It is on 57 South.
Okay.
Just a little ways off. It's a little bit before you get to Kankakee proper. So
okay.
If you're heading south from Chicago, it's a little bit to the west of you.
Right. Okay. So Kankakee River State Park, lots of hikes there, and that's another great one. So let's go. How about if we went a little further north?
Right. I think one of the most famous places as far as foliage and as far as watching the scenery in the fall is probably Galena. And Galena is about 160 miles north. It's actually part of
Chicago.
Yes. It's part of, this is really interesting, Nyla, it's part of an old stagecoach trail that used to run Chicago-Galena. On the way to Galena, stop at Rockford and see, we have one of these little ex-libris of the state, the Anderson Japanese Gardens. And they're some of the most beautiful in the United States. And the foliage along the beautiful landscape Japanese gardens is just absolutely magnificent. You know, the little waterfalls, The lily ponds, the meditation gardens. There's a beautiful tea house tucked away in a corner. That's an absolute marvel.
And there's some interesting history around there, right? Is that also where Ulysses S. Grant
lived
before
right.
the Civil War?
Absolutely. And you have Ulysses S. Grant's house, which you can visit, along also with in Kankakee. You have also the Bradley House. I forgot to mention that earlier.
Oh, right. That's one of the Frank Lloyd Wright houses.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. There's a little gem of a house by Frank Lloyd Wright called Bradley House in Kankakee. But yes, you're absolutely right. Those are Ulysses S. Grant's stomping grounds. There's a variety of tours that you can take. And I think one of the easiest things that you could do for our listeners who are not familiar with the area is to contact the local historical societies. They often have a variety of tours. They act as excellent local guides to the area.
We've got lots of lists here. Nuno and I'm with Nuno Ribeiro. He's at University of Illinois. And I feel like the University of Illinois' most excited ambassador of tourism for Illinois who's with us.
I certainly hope so.
So there's a lot of details. We're going to tweet all of these out. So we've gone through quite a few. We still have a couple more to go through. But if you follow us, our handle is 21ST Show. It looks like there's some folks who love on Twitter. Rose on Twitter says she's a big fan of the Thai house. So there you go. You've got one.
Great.
You've got one person also who's agreeing with you there on your plans, Nuno. Another thing about Galena, actually, you had some food you wanted
sure.
to recommend as well.
This is, I think, one of my favorite places to eat German and French food. There's a little bistro called Fritz and Frit. I heartily recommend the schnitzel and the poulet rôti. It's a tiny little French bistro, very quaint, very interesting, that serves excellent food. And it's a little bit outside of the ordinary. So I think our listeners would definitely enjoy stopping by. I would also have them check out the Belvedere Mansion, which is a little gem of an architectural turn of the century, mid-1800s, early 1900s, just absolutely magnificent. Go and visit.
So we have done almost all of the state, but we would be very remiss if we neglected the southern part of the state.
Yes,
and we haven't
we
talked about
would.
Shawnee National Forest, which
yes.
I imagine must be so beautiful this time of
year.
Oh,
my goodness, Nyla. It is magnificent. The only reason why I hesitate to mention in the beginning is just it's a little bit further drive, but believe me, to the people who are listening to us, it is absolutely worth it.
And so you recommend Dixon Springs State Park?
Right. No? So it's part of the actual Shawnee National Forest, which is about 200 miles south of Champaign. And Dixon Springs State Park is within the Shawnee National Forest. All the Shawnee National Forest is amazing, but this is a personal favorite of mine, Nyla. And Dixon Springs State Park has, I think, I have this embedded in my memory. You know, there's a tiny little waterfall. There's a little pathway that opens up. It's almost like a natural mansion that welcomes you. It's just absolutely gorgeous.
And we would remiss if we didn't mention, there's kind of, I think, the one obvious state park we haven't mentioned, which is Starved Rock.
Yes.
Right? And I think Starved Rock is sort of one of the state parks people always think of in uh-huh. Illinois. And imagine this time of year, Starved Rock and Matheson State Park really
right.
popular locations.
They
too.
Are very popular. And I'm so glad you mentioned Matheson State Park, because they're kitty corner to one another. They're very, very close. So if you have made plans to visit Starved Rock State Park, which, by the way, I applaud, I think it's wonderful, do be careful. This time of the year, it starts getting a little bit slippery. Do use appropriate attire and shoes. But Matheson State Park is a scan. It's maybe a 15-minute drive, and they are very, very easily doable within the same day trip. And both Starved Rock and Matheson State Park, they're about 100 miles west of Chicago. So it's very, very doable.
Okay, great. No. So it sounds like we've got some great locations for everybody to do fall drives for. So thank you so much.
You are most welcome.
For joining us for that. Nuno Ribeiro is an assistant professor with the Department of Recreation, Sport, and Tourism at the University of Illinois. We're going to post all of these lists online at 21stshow.org. And you can always see, we're going to tweet it out as well at 21ST Show. Nuno, thank you so much. I appreciate
it. You're most welcome. It was a pleasure.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app as well. If you search for the 21st, we're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play the 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. As we mentioned, if you want to drop us an email, leave us a voicemail, it's all at our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Robin Lynn, Alan Montecelio, and Bob Holly. Libby Foster and Gray Stetson are our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm broadcasting today from the Medill Graduate School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.